exploring Earth's deep oceans and the state of commercial space. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. This is a space podcast, but we can learn a lot about space exploration from our planet's oceans. On the special series for NPR called Shortwave Sea Camp, a team of science journalists explore the deep blue sea. We'll speak with NPR's Regina Barber and Emily Kwong about Earth's oceans, what we can learn from them, and how space and the sea tie together. Then, what's happening in the world of commercial space? From launching mega rockets to privately crewed missions to the International Space Station, commercial space companies have been busy. But could potential budget cuts to NASA impact the commercial space sector? We'll speak with the host of Main Engine Cutoff, Anthony Colangelo, about what's going on in the world of commercial space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You know, while this podcast is all about exploring the cosmos, sometimes to learn about the stars and our place in the universe, you have to look for answers here on our home planet. Covering 70% of Earth, the oceans dominate our planet, but not much is known about them. And fun fact, more people have explored space than the deepest parts of our ocean. Here to talk about those ocean mysteries and how Earth's water can help humanity in the future is NPR's Regina Barber and Emily Kwong. They are both co-hosts of the podcast Shortwave, and their new series, Sea Camp, is out now. Regina, Emily, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brendan. We're excited to be here.
Great to have you both. Hey, so last summer, the series was Space Camp, explored the weird, wonderful things happening in the universe. You talked about exploding stars, supermassive black holes, how the body reacts to space flight. But this summer, the focus is a bit closer to home, our oceans. How did you and your team decide on this for the series?
It's the only other last frontier, and shockingly, people know less about the ocean than they do about space, and which is interesting given that we really depend on the ocean for our livelihood in much the same way. It produces half the oxygen on Earth. It's the carbon sink that is preventing climate change from cooking us in this very moment. And also, you know, it's home to favorite movies like Finding Nemo, The Little Mermaid, a place of endless beach vacations, a place of fishing. You know, we come from the ocean, potentially. That's one of the theories that life began there. So we wanted to return to it with this series.
Yeah, I mean, to add to what Emily was saying, we were kind of thinking about, you know, we like this thing that we're doing in the summer. We like having like a theme. We like kind of having this idea of exploring. Last year, we kind of were in a metaphorical spaceship going from Earth out into the, you know, the ends of the universe. And we're doing that again with like, you know, a submarine. We're kind of starting at the top and we're going to look into the ocean all the way to the bottom as far as we can know. And I really liked it because we talked a little about the ocean last summer when we talked about Venus, and we said, you know, Venus doesn't have any oceans. It doesn't have that carbon sink. That's why there's a runaway greenhouse effect. So, you know, like I thought it was a good transition from the last summer.
Emily, I'm gonna start with you with this question. When producing the series, what's been the most interesting thing that you have discovered about our oceans?
I think I had heard that the oceans were a carbon sink. I have this board game I really love called Daybreak, where you all work together as different countries to prevent the worst impacts of climate change. And you actually can like sequester carbon in the oceans as like board game tokens, but I didn't really understand how it works. So phytoplankton, these like little plants that are tiny, tiny, and they live in the ocean, they're taking in carbon and producing the oxygen that we were talking about. Like where oxygen comes from, it comes from these phytoplankton. And then the phytoplankton get eaten by fish, and then the fish die, and then their bodies decompose, and they go down to the sea floor, and it gets locked in as carbon. So it's this whole beautiful chain of transference of organic molecules down through the ocean that is like keeping us all going. And I think that's kind of amazing. Like I think of that scene from The Little Mermaid, like under the sea, but I didn't realize all those animals were a part of the carbon cycle too. And it just makes me feel so connected, you know, to them and to life on Earth. So I loved learning more about the carbon cycle and how it works with stabilizing the planet. And yeah, Gina has a cool story about hydrothermal vents.
Yeah. So when I was when I was teaching at a university, I had like this little podcast, and one of my students was talking to a planetary scientist, and I'd always thought like hydrothermal vents, maybe that's where life started. I had read that somewhere when I was younger. And my student asked this professor, and he's like, "No, there's no way that could have happened." And I'm like, "What?" So for years and years and years, I wanted to do a story about like, did life start in these, very hot little chimneys that are on the bottom of our, on our ocean. Deep into our ocean, there are these little chimneys that kind of have heat coming out of them, and they're like these little oases, oases, oasis, I don't know, and animals that like live around them. And this theory was maybe instead of like in the tide pools, or maybe in addition to the tide pools in the beginning of our Earth, life could have started in these pockets. So I did a whole episode on it. I talked to like four or five different scientists, and it was a much bigger debate than I ever would imagined. And it was a really cool reporting activity.
Emily, at the start of our conversation, you mentioned that, the oceans are kind of the last new frontier, right? We don't really know much about what's happening under there. Did you and your team ever uncover why that is the case? Why don't we know much about the ocean?
Oh, that's a really good question. We've only mapped 25% of the sea floor, and it's not through lack of try. It's just that big. It's so vast,
Yeah, our
and
Earth
it's
is mostly
so
water.
deep. Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's a combination of, research priorities, but also just the job of understanding the ocean is immense. And even in our own lifetimes, we probably won't fully understand all of it. So I think it's a question of scale. It's just that big, and we have
Yeah.
no idea how many species are down there.
We did talk to a scientist, and she was talking about even the devices that help you actually study very, very deep into the ocean. It's very high pressures. You have to have very, very special equipment. That's limited too. People rent, scientists rent certain vehicles. So, I mean, it's just also a question or a problem of technology.
But Floridians, you all probably know the ocean much more than most, and we do know quite a bit about the sunlit zone. So that's the first like 200 meters. That's where you have all the oxygen that's being created by these phytoplankton that has happening there. You have all these really cool marine invertebrates that are there that are super diverse and interesting. So we know certain parts better. The mystery really lies in these deeper areas, like where it's completely dark and monster movie-like creatures live down there. Like, that scene in Finding Nemo where Dory and Marlin go down and there's an anglerfish with a little light bulb in front of its head, and they're like, "What's that?" And they're trying to figure out the address for the dentist's office. And that's where the mystery is, right? It's in these deep, dark, very hard to reach places.
This podcast you are on now is a space podcast, so it's very hard for me to not ask a space question.
Well, Gina's an astrophysicist, so ask your
Perfect.
questions.
Okay, fantastic.
Technically,
Well,
yes.
so last summer you did space camp. This summer you're doing sea camp. What parallels do you see in exploring both space and our oceans?
I mean, to me, it's not even a parallel. It's literally like an essential, like when we're talking about these hydrothermal vents, these points in our ocean where no life exists except for in these little hot pockets, we think that that might exist in some of the moons of Jupiter. There are ocean worlds all in our solar system. So if we can understand a little bit about what's happening in our ocean, maybe we might be able to use that knowledge to speculate what might be happening in these moons of Jupiter. So for me, because I'm kind of obsessed with these moons of Jupiter, that there might be life in these ocean worlds, I think it's really essential that we are, studying these oceans, studying anything that might exist on another planet or another moon of another planet.
Yeah, if you like aliens, you should like the ocean.
Okay. Sounds good. Yeah. I'm going to end our conversation with kind of an absurd question. So just go with me here. If you didn't have to worry about things like breathing or water pressure or water temperature, where is a place in our oceans that you would want to hang out for a day?
Oh my gosh, incredible question. I think I would want to hang out in what's known as the Twilight Zone because it's where the largest migration takes place every day. It's where 90% of fish live. So I would want to sit on some Could I sit down there? I want to hang out while watching massive bodies of fish just move about their day. I would want to be in that marine highway and seeing this exchange. I would want to see the predator food chains. I'd want to see mating happen. I just want to see the chaos. Like, I'd want to be in the carnival, the Twilight Zone, but it's out of reach of the sunlight, so I'd need some kind of like special night vision. What about you, Gina? This is an amazing question.
I, as Emily knows, am afraid of marine animals.
Oh yeah,
I'm
Gina's a little
afraid of
afraid
marine
of
animals.
Likewise, yes.
They're so big. I know they're not going to eat me, but it's just I'm terrified of animals in the ocean and a little bit on land. But I have just started watching One Piece, an anime that has been going on since 1999, and I really like sea, like pirates, and I love like ocean wrecks, and I, you know, the Goonies. I would love to go to some area where there's just a ton of shipwrecks. Emily got me to read this book about like ship longitude and how scientists didn't know how to figure out longitude. Latitude is very easy, like looking at the sun, but looking at, you know, east to west location is very, very hard. And there, I would love to see some shipwrecks. Is that terrible? And be away from animals.
Sounds good. Emily, Regina, thank you so much for joining us.
Brennan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Regina Barber and Emily Kwong, their co-hosts of NPR's podcast Shortwave and the podcast series Sea Camp. You can get Shortwave Sea Camp wherever you get this podcast. Still to come, a glimpse into the world of commercial space.
What we've seen from Axiom and from some of the other commercial space station companies is an outreach to governments around the world that are interested in having a space program but don't have the NASA level of funding to be able to do that. So can they kind of, you know, spread it around many different partners that are interested in having their own national astronauts or having crew time on orbit?
Commercial space updates, that's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Scientists are bringing the moon back to Earth, artificially. In a lab, University of Central Florida professor Dan Britt is making moon dust. Agencies like NASA and the Florida Space Institute don't have access to the moon every day, so having artificial moon dust is vital as humans move towards exploring the moon. Find out why. That's on a future episode of Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about commercial space. How are commercial space companies faring under a new presidential administration? And how are commercial companies like SpaceX and Axiom working with international partners on the International Space Station? We're here to answer those questions and update us on the world of commercial space is the host of the podcast, Main Engine Cutoff, Anthony Colangelo. Anthony, welcome back to the show.
Always good to be back with you, Brendan. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, plenty to talk about, so let's jump straight into it. It's time for another commercial space update. Let's start with a big story. We're about 6 months into this administration, 7 months into the year. A lot of changes coming from this presidential administration when it comes to space exploration. How are commercial companies faring in this particular environment?
You know, everyone feels clenched right now. Like there's a lot of news and not a lot of announcements out of the companies of exactly what they want to do or where they want to go or what programs they really want to take part in. You know, there's sort of the dual situation here where we've got budget requests that cut a lot of funding out of science. So science missions are quite down, put a lot of money into exploration in many cases. You know, even in the biggest, most headline grabbing case of trying to cancel the later Artemis missions, that shifts a lot of the focus to the more commercial alternatives. It's in that case, it's kind of the big old primes, the Boeing, Lockheed Martins of the world, Northrop Grumman's that are fighting to kind of keep enough of the current manifest in their wheelhouse because that's the contracts they have. And the other companies, you know, wouldn't necessarily mind if it went that way. Now, the congressional response has been a resounding no to that. So we'll see exactly how these budget requests or budget proposals make their way through Congress. They're in both houses right now. Working on some of the finer details and fighting over the last few bits. But on the space side of things, they've got nearly full funding rather than what was a pretty dramatic cut out of the administration. So Will that come to pass? Will it come to pass before there's more chaos that ensues by the end of the fiscal year? Because there could be effects where the administration is able to cancel missions before the budget actually gets signed. So there's still a lot of, I think because of that is why I'm saying all the companies are clenched, is that there's kind of a 4-month uncertainty range here where nobody's quite sure exactly how it will shake out. So the best thing to do is kind of promote what you're good at. Talk about the things that you want to do, but try to read the tea leaves a little bit more before you commit really hard in any particular direction. And that's on the civil space side. I should mention on the defense side, there is a lot of positioning for the Golden Dome program. People see that as a huge opportunity. I think participating in the more militaristic programs in the country is kind of in again. That was something from the early 2000s through now that wasn't really cool to talk about. And it was, you know, I don't know if that was culturally, it was just not as interesting. And certainly the last few years have been geopolitically interesting with wars going on around the world that involve a lot of space assets. So you've seen a lot of pivoting from space companies into the defense world. And whether that's following the market or, you know, they realize how useful their assets are over in the military side, that has been a big shift that we've been seeing as well.
Interesting observation. Anthony, I want to go back to talking about the civil part of space exploration and the private companies involved in that, because, you know, at a broad sense, these Trump administration cuts, you know, the argument has been, you know, they are not needed and the private industry can take on the, you know, the slack. They can fill in the gaps. But in the commercial space industry, they are so reliant on the federal government for a lot of this stuff, right? I mean, is there a way that these private companies can fill in the gaps in the civil space industry if, in fact, the Trump administration does get its budget cuts in and Congress can't save it?
I mean, you're right in that most of these companies doing, especially on the human spaceflight side, NASA is the anchor customer. Their business case doesn't close without NASA taking a huge amount of their capacity, whether that's flights in the case of human space flights up or for commercial space station companies, actual crew time on orbit. They need that big NASA anchor to make the business case close. Now, what we've seen from Axiom and from some of the other commercial space station companies is an outreach to governments around the world that are interested in having a space program, but don't have the NASA level of funding to be able to do that. So can they kind of, you know, spread it around many different partners that are interested in having their own national astronauts or having crew time on orbit, or even, you know, Europe, we're heading into in this November, there's the ESA, the European Space Agency ministerial meeting. Every couple of years, all the governments come together to decide how much funding there should be for the different programs in ESA's purview. And human spaceflight has been something that has been talked about in the last couple of cycles as like, should we be more involved in human spaceflight rather than just hitching a ride with NASA? Should we have big flagship programs? You've seen a consortium around the Voyager Space Starlab space station. They've been partnering with Airbus out of Europe. They've been partnering with some Japanese companies as well, trying to reach out to the other ISS partners to have a foothold there where, you know, they have serious cash to spend. It's not as much as NASA, so it pales in comparison, but it's still billions of dollars per year that is available through those different space agencies. So, you know, can you sort of put more emphasis on those international partners? And in many cases, you know, Europe is in a situation where they want to be a bigger player in the space policy world. They see the importance of it as the relationship with the U.S. falters a little bit, as they've got struggles with Russia as well. And they want to show that they're still capable of these big grand programs. That often drives, you know, funding over the history of space that we've seen is when you want to show your stuff, you go to space, you spend a lot of money, you do big flashy programs. So that could be something that we see out of Europe that's, I wouldn't be shocked in November to hear some news like that.
One of the companies that is leveraging that that comes to mind to me is Axiom Space, which we just saw Axiom 4 launched astronauts for the countries of India, Poland, and Hungary. How do you see Axiom Space transitioning to this far more private, less reliant on NASA future?
Axiom's been in a bit of a struggle, I think, not only because, you know, space projects timeline slip. So the hardware that they've got for their own space station seems to be a little bit behind. We're seeing photos of hardware, but it's not very far along yet. So they're still a few years out from their own space station module launching up to the ISS. And then they get into problem of all of a sudden they're launching a module up to the ISS that's about to be decommissioned. And are they ready to make it a free flying space station yet? That they're going to get in a weird kind of squeeze position if they're not able to get this hardware moving a little faster. At the same time, they have been flying these private astronaut missions from all reporting, they don't really make money on those. Those may be loss leaders, but it's a good way for them to stoke these relationships with countries that don't have an astronaut corps already, but would like one. And that's, you know, maybe it's a little bit of them trying to build up future customers for their future space station and future programs. But that only goes so far if you're not able to, you know, keep the operating expenses paid for by the time that you're actually, you know, building out a space station. So I still feel like they're in a little bit of an awkward spot. They were the clear leader for a while. Not only the team that they have was a lot of ISS, you know, alumni. Now they have had some leadership turnover as well. So we don't get a lot from internal there, but it does seem like it's been a tumultuous few years. And it's a very unclear path ahead for Axiom from where they are now to a free flying space station.
Mm-hmm. Who do you think is the front runner at this point for that first commercial space station?
Man, everybody's saying it, but I think the company called VAST is a really interesting one to watch. They are outside of the NASA programs around these commercial space stations. And I do think that's kind of imposing some constraints on them in a way that could make them more successful than the others. You know, the others have been part of these NASA programs to design their space stations. And eventually the idea was to then get funding from NASA to go build them out and fly them. That funding has been hard to come by. You know, NASA hasn't been requesting a lot of it from Congress at a time where I've been very critical, specifically of the Bill Nelson era NASA, that they had geopolitical situations in front of them that would allow them to go to Congress and say, we need more money for commercial space stations. The ISS is falling apart. Our relationship with Russia is falling apart. We need to make sure there's a space station to fly. They didn't do that. So the funding is very tight on that NASA program that the other competitors have been banking on. So VAST has had to find a different way. They've sort of taken the let's be the SpaceX of space stations approach to do things from a first principles perspective. They're not long-lived space stations, so they're going to launch a module, fly a couple missions to it, and then launch the next one beyond that, which I think helps a lot of the initial investment. So we could see them start to fly pretty soon. They've got some missions with SpaceX already signed up. They have been the ones talked about as bidding for these other private astronaut missions to the ISS. So they seem serious. They've got a great team. They've got a lot of funding. And it seems like they got the right vision to actually go and launch one of these things.
Let's turn to SpaceX, Anthony. Last month, you spoke with Lori Garver, who's the former NASA deputy administrator, about some of the potential fallout from Elon Musk and President Trump's very public breakup and implications for SpaceX and the future of space exploration. What did you learn from Lori, and have you seen any of that stuff coming to fruition in the month of July?
Yeah, there was some reporting this past week there were people within the Trump administration that did look into, you know, could we cancel these SpaceX contracts or, you know, whatever retribution style steps they might take there. And the report was, no, these are all really critical to what we're doing. And, you know, you and I and people listening to this know that this position that SpaceX has in the space industry, they are just the dominant player in all respects: human space flight, satellite launches, operating satellites, commercial broadband satellites, the things that they offer out of that to the military side. They are absolutely dominant by the way that they have worked very hard and built great products over the past, you know, decade or two, and have taken that position because they deserve it because of the output. And now they're in a situation where, you know, Elon Musk has, over the last 5 years, when he's gotten increasingly political, has now made enemies on all sides. So that's the thing that I've always found odd, and that's what Lori and I were talking about, was this feels like a very short-term thinking kind of positioning from Elon Musk, that, you know, when he either falls out with the current administration or the new administration comes along or a new party is in charge, he doesn't have any real good base of support to build from. So when he's trying to have a company focus on very long-term missions like humans to Mars or building out reusable space infrastructure, it's not a great situation to make enemies out of everybody that needs to, you know, green check all of your paperwork to make that possible. Now, SpaceX also, this is the other aspect of Lori and I's conversation, is because of what we just talked about, that SpaceX has been so successful and they have such a source of revenue in Starlink, they are achieving escape velocity from national politics. And so, you know, are they as dependent on NASA policy as they were when they were young? No, not anymore, right? They have the ability to go out and fund gargantuan programs like the Starship program themselves, or Starlink itself was a miraculous turn in that they were able to make that a thing that generates huge amounts of revenue. So I do think to some extent they're growing their way out of being dependent on NASA in that way. So, you know, I think part of the flippancy, if that's a word, that Elon has had towards the ISS program or the Artemis program generally, is that it's not as necessary anymore for the vision that he has for SpaceX and beyond.
Well, while SpaceX may be less dependent on NASA moving forward, NASA's Artemis program is extremely dependent on SpaceX's Starship, which quite simply keeps blowing up. what do we know about what's happening with Starship, and will it be available for Artemis whenever that may happen?
Yeah, I mean, it will be available for Artemis when it happens, because when it happens is dependent on when it's available to some extent. Right now, I think it's per our last topic, Axiom Space is getting some good cover for their spacesuit development as well. That's another aspect that would be a long pole for the Artemis 3 landing. But yeah, Starship has had a terrible year. And not only have they had a terrible year in their actual flights, they had this issue on the test stand recently where they blew up an entire Starship, greatly damaged the test stand that they use to check these vehicles out before they go to flight. So in the intervening time, we've seen like, all right, well, that test site's going to need a lot of work. It's going to be months of work to get that back online. Maybe we can change around some of the infrastructure we have out at the coast in Texas to be able to do that test firing in need of a ship and then get another flight off. So it does seem like they're nearing another test flight. But the problem is they haven't moved the ball forward this year at all with the Starship program. Everything they've been trying to test, from the heat shields to in-flight propellant transfers to even lighting Raptor engines in space, they've done it once before, but they still need more testing of that. And certainly they've moved some of the kind of flaps and fins around on the ship. They haven't been able to test out how those work on reentry. So there's a huge list of things that they have had. Oh, and I should mention, they haven't deployed payloads from the ship yet. The door got stuck one time. They were in too much of a spin to deploy another time. So everything they had set out for them to do in 2025, they haven't made any progress on. And that's just pushed them farther and farther behind, as not only do they need to actually do those tasks, they need to figure out what keeps going wrong each time they have a flight or a test incident. So it's been, I would hope, rock bottom for the Starship program for the past few months. We keep thinking, all right, maybe this is the flight they're going to turn the corner. But here we are again. Maybe this flight that will turn the corner on these issues and start making that progress that we got so used to over the years.
Lots to keep an eye on. Glad you are doing it for us, Anthony. Anthony Colangelo is the host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff. Anthony, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Brendan.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcast. You can stay connected with this show on social media. Our handle is at AWTY Space. If you've got an idea for a future episode of the show, burning question, or you want to join us as a guest, well, reach out to us. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Ashley Reap. Our producer, Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.